is up, guys? Welcome back to the Zach and Pat Show. I'm Zach.
I'm Pat.
This is the show about manhood, fatherhood, entrepreneurship, and the mentality it takes to be successful in those things. And we'll probably sprinkle in some helpful real estate advice for Pat and you. You know, guys, life can be tough. We can go through some things and struggle at times. This is the show to let you know that you're not alone. So if you're someone out there going through any of this stuff, this is the show for you. Let's get some housekeeping out of the way. Before we get started, though, we haven't asked for this in a while. If you guys could, please hit that subscribe button. That helps us out a ton. Hit like, also comment down below. And if you could, go on any of the other platforms like Spotify or Apple Podcasts and write us a review. That would help us out a ton. You know, we've never really asked for those before. So that's just something I wanted to kind of, you know, throw out there. If you guys could do that for us, we would really, really appreciate it. And shout out to our friends at NeuroGum for keeping us energized and focused throughout the show and throughout our weeks. NeuroGum is it's a gum with caffeine and nootropics. It helps me kind of stay focused. I'll chew it, you know, while I'm drilling in jiu-jitsu, while I'm working out, during podcasts, while I'm, you know, driving around showing houses. Just kind of keeps me alert. It's got a little caffeine in it, little boost. So go check out some NeuroGum.
Also, shout out to our people over at Fit Flavors. We have currently a discount code through the end of May. So go online, buy online gift cards, one time per person, and using the promo code podcast50, we'll get you 50% off. I mean, I love Fit Flavors. I'm constantly running around and on the go. I mean, I just ate one before here. It's great. I mean, macros are counted out. It's very easy. It takes a minute and a half to microwave. Everything's fresh. Nothing spoils. Well, if you wait too long, it will go bad because it's fresh food.
R.I.P. broccoli.
Yeah, broccoli. But yeah, I mean, I went on, got a $1,000 gift card for $500. Can't beat it.
Yeah, 50% off. Why not?
All right.
So yeah, use promo code podcast50. Also, so today is a guest episode. We have a guest in studio. He is a brown belt. He is a new father, a former special agent from in the FBI, former St. Louis City police officer, the great and powerful Uzo Onwumare. What's up, dude? Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let's kind of tell the people a little bit about yourself. Give us a little intro about who is Uzo.
All right, cool. I was born and raised here in St. Louis. Went to Clayton High School. I know saying where you went to high school.
Yeah, for sure.
That's the first Clayton I've ever heard.
Yeah. So, born and raised here. Like I said, my parents were, I'm Nigerian. Parents were born and raised in Nigeria. They came over here in the 80s. And then had me, my siblings and everything like that.
And how many siblings do you have?
I've got a younger brother, two younger sisters and two older half brothers.
Okay.
Yeah. They're all over. My middle sister's in California doing med school, other sisters in Chicago also doing med school, brothers in finance, and my other half brother lives in Australia. He's actually on the national Australian dodgeball team.
Damn,
which I didn't know was a thing.
That's cool.
And my other brother lives out in Wentzville.
Cool.
Very cool.
Sweet.
Yeah. Your parents still here?
Yeah. Yeah. They live in the Central West End.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Nice. So grew up here. What'd you do? You went to Clayton for high school? What'd you do after high school?
I went to Mizzou for my undergrad. I went for political science with an emphasis in international relations and why countries go to war. Didn't end up using that. Came back here to St. Louis for my master's in the same thing. Still didn't really end up using it. I was probably going to go to law school. That's what my parents wanted. And since they were fitting the bill for education, they kind of that was the path I was supposed to be on. And then in college, I actually met with an FBI recruiter. They had all the agencies come. It was like career day or something on campus at Mizzou. And I remember seeing those two agents. They just looked completely professional. And I was like, okay, that's the path I want to go on. So I kind of talked to them, started changing my, because it was the first time I was away from home. So I kind of spent a lot of time partying more than I should have.
Sure, don't everything, we all?
But seeing those two guys kind of squared me away to what I wanted to eventually get to. And that's kind of where I joined the police department. I wanted to have some law enforcement experience before I went to the bureau.
Okay. So you went to St. Louis Police Department?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I went to the academy here in St. Louis right after I finished my master's program. Maybe not like right after. Application process took about 4 or 5 months. But I also had an application out with the Navy as well because I wanted to go into the intel field. So it was between military and law enforcement, which is pretty much usually what the FBI recruits from. I mean, all you need is a 4-year degree to get into the Bureau, but they heavily favor prior law enforcement experience or military experience.
Well, makes sense because it's like more physical application. It's more like in the field, you know.
Yeah, and it's a quasi military organization. Sure. I mean, we do room entries, we do search warrants, all those types of things.
Were you metro or county?
I was metro.
Okay.
Yep.
What were the years that you were there?
I was 2016 to 2019.
Did you ever work with Clint Cashin, country boy from Kentucky?
I don't think so.
No,
I don't think so. If I had a picture of him, I might be able to
recognize him.
Yeah,
I guess there's a ton of people that work there. So
yeah. It's got to be a big department.
Yeah. I mean it's smaller now, but it used to be pretty big. But yeah, that was the route that I took. Again, it was between military and law enforcement, but the law enforcement application just went faster. Sure. I think from application to actually going to my first day was about 5 months. So I guess I kind of lucked out at the time. They were kind of looking for more people to apply. So I kind of got in that way. And I was in North St. Louis as a patrolman for all 3 years.
Damn.
Yeah, so it was a wild ride.
I was gonna say, for those of you that don't know, you know, North St. Louis is... You know, it can be some of the rougher parts of town, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
There's rougher parts everywhere, but...
The Brown...
Michael Brown.
Michael Brown situation.
Ferguson.
Ferguson, yeah.
Yeah. North St. Louis Police has a saying that it's the home of the real police, because we deal with a lot more than most other divisions. But now...
Well, they're going out, being on foot. Yeah. Probably chasing people down, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It was fun.
I'm sure you got some stories.
Did you work with Michael Langsdorff at all?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So he got his real estate license when he was going through a transition period there, and he worked with my business partner and I.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, he's a good dude.
Yeah. So you spent 3 years as a patrolman. Yep. And then what from there?
And then so in my third year is when I sent an application out to the Bureau. It was mostly on a whim. I was just like, I'll just put it out there just to see if I can get in. I also put one out with the DEA and the air marshals too, because I just thought
that'd be a fun job.
Yeah, that would be fun. I thought that would be fun. But the Bureau got back to me, and I went through a year long application process. It usually doesn't take a year, but during that time there was that federal hiring freeze. So when that lifted, I had to redo my fitness test and another test.
So this is like 2020?
No, because I got it in 2019.
Okay.
So it was 2018, I think, I want to say. Or 20... Yeah, sometime around 2018. Between 2018 and 2019, when that hiring freeze was happening. So I had to redo two sections of the application process. It usually doesn't take that long.
I mean, I feel like an application process for the FBI has got to be ridiculously strenuous.
Yeah, parts of it are.
I feel like they got to know,
everything about
what you did in second grade.
So,
Times did you get a detention in grade school, you know?
Yeah, that part is pretty invasive, because it's you have to take a written test. There's also a 3-person panel where they kind of interview you for the position. You have got to do a fitness test, a medical background. It's kind of like how you would go through like MEPS if you were going through the military, like all that processing. And then you have to do a polygraph, which was probably the most invasive thing I've ever experienced, because there's different levels of polygraph. There's counterintelligence polygraph. There's a full scope polygraph, and that's the one the Bureau does. So they're going into your life, like picking through it, everything. And but that process is it's an ordeal.
Oh, I believe
to go through it. I mean, they go back, you know, who you've known for the past 10 years, where you've lived. They interview people pretty extensively. And once you pass that, you end up getting a clearance, which is, depending on what you work in the Bureau, you're probably going to need that clearance, along with little caveats like a SCI or something like that.
So you go through the application process, you get clearance, and then you're in? Is that?
Yeah, so then you go to Quantico.
Oh, okay.
So Quantico is like
DMV area.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's in Virginia, right?
Yeah. Virginia.
Yeah.
And that process, depending on when you go in, is a 5 to 6 month process. It's like being back in college. You study on your own time. You go through like all the training with your section. So say for my class, was a class of 200, but they split up every section, Alpha Charlie, Alpha Bravo, Charlie Delta, 50 people in each class. But they split the class between people that wanted to go the special agent route and then also people that wanted to go the intel analyst. So they combined intel analysts with special agents.
Can you tell us what the difference between those two
are? Yeah, so special agents are the ones that carry the gun and the badge. They're out in the field. Intel analysts are the ones that support the investigations from, like, the field office. They do all,
the,
like,
nerds behind the screens.
Yeah, yeah.
Got it.
And they're, so they have us together in the academy so they can see what we do and we can see what they do. But they graduate, I don't remember if it was, like, 11 weeks before we do. So after that 11-week mark, we watch them graduate, and then the rest of the training is just agents until we graduate.
Damn, that's cool.
Yeah, and they usually have 3 or 4 classes running at a time. So we were the freshman class, and then as we got closer to graduation, more classes came through. They also house the National Academy, which is for law enforcement. So if I was a sergeant, I can go to the National Academy, get some training through the Bureau. So we had a lot of people coming through when I was going through.
Wait, so how long to, so this is 2018, 2019, you're getting
Yeah,
in.
This was 2019 and then to 2020.
How many years are you with the FBI?
Or like, I was
when, what are you doing there exactly, if you can?
Oh, yeah. So I was with them from 2019 to 2022. I did a lot. I did Chinese counterintelligence, did some stints with their covert surveillance unit. White collar crime for a while, doing like hospice care fraud and embezzlement, stuff like that. And then I ended with violent crimes and gangs.
Sweet.
Yeah.
I was gonna say, I bet that's gotta be the
Yeah, because that was in California. So that was
that's where you because I know you left St. Louis and you were there for a while. Is that what you were doing?
You're kind of
working on that there.
Yeah. So I got my purple belt under Kyle in 2019 and I left because I got accepted to the Bureau.
Okay, that makes sense. Because I started going to Kyle's in 2020 because I was training somewhere else before. And, I remember you coming back a few times.
Yeah, I missed it.
Like, who's this purple belt who I haven't seen who's just wrecking everybody? Like, small, this small dude who's just destroying everybody. Anyway.
Sorry. Is there any of the stuff that you could touch on that you did while you were out there that you can talk about?
Yeah, the violent crimes and gang stuff because it wasn't classified.
Gotcha.
It was all unclassified. It was just like regular police work. I worked with Inglewood detectives, mm-hmm. and we basically just investigated different gangs. I was on a Mexican gang and black gang squad.
Okay.
So me and my case agent, there were two agents assigned to the task force. So it was us two and then like 7 other Inglewood detectives, and we would just run cases, do buys.
Like MS-13, that group, or like
offshoots of them.
Gotcha.
Yeah, offshoots of them in Inglewood.
Okay.
So just like busting drugs, guns.
Yeah, doing search warrants.
Picking indoors.
Yeah, wiretaps, all that type of stuff.
Now, I mean, here in the Midwest, I guess, a lot of people are probably just ignorant to the fact that there are gangs and stuff like that. Like, how prevalent is the gang life and activity out there?
Oh, man.
Or around, just around the country in general?
It's pretty prevalent. California, especially like the Los Angeles, Inglewood area is pretty well known for their Bloods and Crips. Like that's where they originated. Lately there's been a lot of influx of like, Latin gangs coming through. And there was a lot, like I did some gang work here in St. Louis, up in North St. Louis. So I was well versed in that, but it's pretty small compared to what is going on, down in LA.
Yeah, especially being that close to the border. And
yeah.
So it was on a massive scale.
Okay. So then, so you do that for those 3 years and then what?
So during that time, it was just becoming a little bit harder to live in California. Like during COVID, yeah, man, it was brutal, man. Gas prices were like $8 a gallon.
Holy shit.
Now I had a government vehicle. So like, I had a government card, so I didn't have to worry about that. Yeah. But I still had my personal vehicle that I had to fill up, and it was killing us.
Yeah.
And me and my wife, we decided that we wanted to start having kids, raise a family, and it was just me and her out there. So it was kind of hard, no family around, you know.
Sure, dude.
So I decided that I wanted to, Well, before we left, I decided I wanted to transition into their cyber division. So the Bureau kind of has like five different divisions. CRIM, which is what we call it, which is criminal. Counterintelligence, counterterrorism, WMD, and cyber. And I wanted to transition into cyber because during COVID, I don't know if you guys remember, there was that pipeline hack on the East Coast where it just drove gas prices through the roof. And I was like, wait, people can hack our systems like that from across this, like from across the world and actually affect gas prices. So
it's a problem.
And I build computers. I'm kind of a nerd. I dabble in programming and stuff. So I was like, okay, I want to transition to that aspect of it. So I told, you know, my bureau management that, hey, I'm trying to transfer, but we were down, I think like three or four agents on our squad. So me leaving was kind of, we would be understaffed for that squad. And they were talking about like 6 to 8 years to transfer. And that's not typical of the Bureau. The LA is so big. It's the third biggest field office. So it's hard to get people to transfer their entire family to LA. And it's hard to leave once you get there. The upside is that you can work pretty much any type of criminal violation because it's so big. You see everything. When I was going through, I was a single male at the time. So when I got out there, they were like, okay, perfect. You don't have a family to move. It's a lot easier for you to go out there. And I put it on my list. I put it on my list because of the jiu-jitsu.
For sure.
Yeah. Jiu-jitsu and weather, that was my list. So when I talk about the list, when you're in the academy, I forget what week, but you rank all of the field offices from 1 to 56, 1 being the one you want the most, 56 being the one you want the least. These field offices include Anchorage, Alaska, Puerto Rico. So if you don't want to be anywhere there, make sure that's on the bottom of your list. I put, I think it was L.A., San Diego, San Francisco, Sacramento. Like,
yeah, you want to be on that coast. West Coast.
Yeah. Just because it's the mecca for jiu-jitsu, I was like, okay, perfect.
Well, one of these cities, there's legendary schools.
Exactly.
Every single one of them.
Yeah. Exactly. So that's how I...
Now it'd be Austin, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Austin would be on there now.
Yeah. Now I'd probably, if I was going through it now, I'd probably change up my list to include some of the southern areas.
Yeah. Florida.
Yeah.
Austin.
Pretty much. Austin would probably
Austin
be where I'd want to go.
Austin's like the jiu-jitsu mecca now.
Yeah.
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah. but that's what got me out there. So it just became, after a while, it just became really hard to, you know, afford to live out there, especially thinking about having a kid. So
yeah, and you're like, yeah, especially with everything going on COVID. I mean, if you look at what was going on there versus what was going on here, it was completely different.
Yeah,
you
know? It's totally different.
It was great. Or
we thought we had it bad.
Well, California is one of the strictest when it came to COVID. So
they were under a state of emergency for 3 years.
Yeah. Right. It was good for getting to places on time, though.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
There was like nobody traffic. On the roads. Like to get somewhere, it didn't take an hour and 45 minutes to go 12 miles. I could actually get to places. Because for the Bureau, I do remember we worked from home. Like when COVID was first coming out and no one knew exactly what it was, they did allow us to work from home. But then after a while, they were like, you guys are essential, back to work,
yeah,
kind of thing.
In the office.
And it makes sense because it's hard to do, you know, an interview with people over the phone. Like, first of all, if I call somebody and I say, hey, I'm an FBI agent, they're hanging up.
Right.
And then, right.
I hear that. I'm like, well, it can't be for me.
Yeah, exactly. And because nobody really meets us. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not like a uniform presence, like local law enforcement. So if you meet us, it's going to be a bad day for you because we have everything we need to arrest you. That's when you usually meet the agent. That's when they usually kick in your door when they've built the case from start to finish.
You don't know that they're there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So when you try to call somebody and say, hey, I'm an FBI agent, even if you know their name, you know, pertinent information for the case, they're just like, yeah, okay, click, you know? Mm-hmm. So they were like, we can't really sustain
do
this.
Do your job.
Yeah. You can't really do it. Yeah. And, the fact we use, you know, classified systems too, you can't really do that from home. So after a while, they were like, okay, we need to get you guys back in the office, which was fine for me because, again, I could move freely. You know, I wasn't waiting in traffic all the time.
Yeah, because, I mean, how far did you live from your office?
Oh, I lived far. So I lived in Pasadena.
Okay, heard of that.
So it was, on a good day, it was like 53 minutes away.
Without traffic.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. With traffic.
With traffic. But how far, if there's zero traffic?
It was like.
You don't even have to stop at a stoplight. Like what?
Like 23 minutes maybe.
Yeah.
So it wasn't too bad.
But no, but still.
So mileage-wise, that'd be going from here to St. Charles?
Yeah. Yeah. So it wasn't too bad. Yeah, with no people.
With no people, yeah.
But I do distinctly remember multiple times when I leave the office, if I left at 4:15, I'm hitting the 110. The highways always say the.
Yeah, so it's the 109.
Yeah.
I've heard of that.
Which was weird for me because we don't do that here.
It's Highway 55.
Yeah.
Highway
the 270.
Yeah, yeah.
The 270,
yeah.
So I'd hit the 110 and I'd be in traffic for an hour and 45 minutes to go maybe 16 miles.
Oh, sucks.
So yeah,
that sounds terrible.
Yeah, it was not fun. I got to catch up on a lot of podcasts though.
Oh, I'm sure.
Audio
positive. Yeah, it for sure.
But I there were some times where I was spending more time driving and being in the car than actually interviewing. So if I needed to go to Long Beach to do an interview, I'd spend more time in the car than the actual interview. Mm-hmm. It was just getting to be a little bit too much. The weather in jiu-jitsu can only carry you so far.
For sure. 100%.
The logistics of living there was a little much.
The logistics of living there and the price and the cost, sure, renting an apartment or something there, I'm assuming, and I'm sure the rent was astronomical.
It was.
I dated a girl in Southern California and her rent was $3,250 a month for a place that's no bigger than my house.
Yeah, so that Pasadena place was $3,000 a month on top of utilities.
Yeah.
And it was it was a house that they had split in half.
Like a duplex?
Yeah. So we lived on one side, our neighbors lived on the other side. Nice backyard, but it was pricey.
Yeah, oh, for sure. It's crazy.
And before that though, when I first moved down there because I didn't know which area. I mean, I had an idea of which areas you don't want to live in, especially if you're law enforcement. But I ended up living in East, in Boyle Heights, which is East Los Angeles, which was not a great place. The apartment was fantastic. The outside was not. It was, close to this park called Hollenbeck Park. And, I think two people went missing in that park when we lived there for that year. It was there was an underpass, obviously the homeless population.
Yeah, that was another thing. Yeah,
it was pretty bad. It's pretty bad, but it was cheap.
Skid Row,
cheap. Yeah. $3,000 a month. It's cheap. Yeah, crazy. $3,000 a month in St. Louis gets you a palace.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, man. Yeah,
so
crazy.
I was pretty excited to come back.
So yeah, then you come back here. What now?
So I work for Parsons Corporation as a counter insider threat investigator.
So is that a branch of? Yeah, or is it completely?
No, so I'm completely done with the FBI. I am a contractor now with Parsons, and they contract out with DOD. I basically make sure classified systems stay classified. People don't bring stuff in or out that shouldn't be leaving.
Cyber stuff?
It can be, but mostly what we're worried about is data exfiltration. We don't want any classified stuff to be downloaded to USBs and taken out to be sold to foreign adversaries. And we also don't want insider threats like disgruntled employees, that type of stuff.
I don't even think about disgruntled employees, filling up a thumb drive and then, the day they're getting fired or the day that they're leaving and then they go sell that to somebody and make a ton of money.
Or the same vein, disgruntled employees putting a logic bomb on a computer where after a certain amount of time, a program gets set off that starts deleting data or something like that. I've learned quite a bit of different ways people can mess up computer systems. It's pretty.
Does that happen frequently? Can you talk on that?
It happens. I wouldn't say it's on a regular basis, but when it does happen, it's pretty catastrophic.
Yeah.
So again, for whatever reason the employee is disgruntled, they can do quite a bit of damage. Especially if they're knowledgeable about programming and have access to classified systems.
Damn. Crazy.
Well, let's talk about family. So you said your parents are from Nigeria.
Yes.
And you were first born here.
Yep.
What's that culture like?
Oh, man. That culture is, for people who aren't, like, well-versed in it, it's pretty intense. Nigerians are, I don't know the statistic if that's still accurate today, but they're from all the immigrant groups, they're the highest holding degree holders. And that's mostly because Nigerian parents, they push education like nobody's business. The running joke is you're either a lawyer, doctor, engineer, or you disgrace the family. So I'm the disgrace. The former FBI agent is yeah. But they truly push education. My mom's a pharmacist with a specialization in oncology at Barnes, and my dad is a retired PhD professor of micro and macroeconomics. Like I said, both my sisters are the doctor route. My brother's in finance. And then I went, law enforcement to their contractor. So if that's any indication of how that works. But it's a wonderful culture, in my opinion. It took me a while to appreciate it just because, when I was growing up, I couldn't really appreciate it. I was just like, why don't I get to do things that other people get to do? Like, I want to go, fucking drink and do all this type of stuff. My parents really impressed upon me, like, I'm carrying the family name. So that became more prevalent as I became older. I was like, okay, I understand where my parents are coming from. And they sacrificed a lot for me and my siblings to have the life we do now. They grew up during the Nigerian Civil War with the British and, the 1950s and 60s. So they saw a lot, they had to deal with a lot. And education was their path to, the U.S.
Okay. Wow.
So they came here in the 80s?
Yes.
I think as Americans, we could take a playbook out of that.
100%.
With the shit that we're seeing nowadays, we need more of that. And I think that'll help. That would help better our future as a country.
I agree.
If we had that same mentality and those same principles.
Yeah. Yeah, their ability to instill drive was paramount for my success. As soon as I found something I was passionate about, I go all in pretty much.
Yeah.
It's great because it kind of ties into the book that we're reading this month, Mental Toughness by Andy Priscilla.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm at the part where we just read the part where he's like, their family mantra was kill, kill, kill. Not like, it just means be aggressive and push forward with everything that you got, which is, sounds similar to that. What are some of the things that your parents would do growing up that would help instill some of these things into you?
It was mostly, they talked about it a lot. They were very involved in school, my schooling. When I was growing up, actually, this is pretty funny because my mom laughs at this to this day. Excuse me. I was a bad kid. I was like in and out of school suspension. I was getting in fights. I was all that. Like my life was going down a path that it shouldn't have been going down. But my mom was very tenacious. She was always in school, always coming to the principal's office, talking to people, telling them, hey, no, we're going to work this out. We're going to figure out what's going on with this kid. And she was very involved in making sure that I stayed on the right path. And so that was one of the things that they kind of instilled, just being present in your kids' lives, figuring out what's going on, why they're, acting out. And I think I was mostly acting out just because I was bored. I was just like looking for something to do. And again, my parents immigrated here, so they didn't really understand like school systems, like which ones were better than most. So I do remember, I don't know if it exists anymore. It was called Kottmeyer. It was off South Grand. That was like one of the schools I went to, which is not a very good school at all. But they didn't, they didn't know any better.
Right.
And I was their first kid. Well, my dad's third, but my mom's first. So they didn't really know any better. They just thought school was school. And that school was like,
not good.
Yeah,
not,
it was not.
Not,
it was
not Clayton.
No, it was definitely not. So I kind of fell into a crowd of people that just didn't care about much and was following that path. And my mom made sure to steer me straight and get me out of that environment. And then,
And as a new father, what are some of the things that your parents did that you're going to do, or what are some things that you're thinking about doing differently?
Oh man. So there's,
speaking of how old is your daughter?
She will be 6 months, April 30th.
Congratulations. Yeah, that's awesome.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Yeah, she was born October 30th.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah. Welcome to the dad crew.
Yeah, it's been fun. I'm still waiting for that dad strength to kick in a little bit for jiu-jitsu. I've experienced a little bit of it because when we bring it to the gym, I feel like, she's watching.
So. Yeah, for sure, 100%. Yeah.
I also make sure that I roll with some blue belts just to pad it a little bit.
Yeah.
But some of the things that I'm going to keep doing that they're doing is kind of instilling that sense of culture. I definitely don't want that to be lost because my parents, they never taught me the native language, Igbo. And that was mostly because they wanted me and my siblings to assimilate as much as possible. And that was, now that I'm older, that's kind of a big regret because I wish I could be a dual. I can understand it and I can translate quite a bit. I just can't speak. And I think that's an outgrowth of my grandma on my dad's side came over and she doesn't speak any English. So when she would babysit us, that's all she would speak. And I kind of picked it up from there, but I never had the formal
training
to like speak it, you know, in return. Yeah. So I could translate what she was saying into English, but I couldn't speak to her in Igbo. Yeah. And I think that was, that's probably my biggest regret. I think that's one of my parents' regrets too, like not passing on that culture, not allowing for the next generation to have the dual language.
Now, is it like different tribes have different dialects, or is that how that is?
There's three major ethnic groups: Yorubas, Igbos, and Hausas. The dialects are slightly different, but you can kind of tell where somebody's from based on their name. So, like my Uzoma and Onwumere, you can tell that O-N-W-U is usually like Igbo.
Okay.
So it's kind of interesting that way. You can kind of just look at somebody's name and kind of guess where they're from.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the things that I want my daughter to know, is just the culture where, you know, where she comes from.
Nigerian.
Yeah. Just so she can understand, like it's a very rich culture and I don't want her to lose that. I told my parents that I want them to teach her Igbo. So so I missed it on my generation. I don't want her to miss it.
Yeah.
And through her, maybe I can pick it back up or something like that.
Well, that's what
she can teach you.
That's what I'm trying to do with my boys. So my ex-wife is Bosnian.
Okay.
And so when the boys are with her parents, all they do is speak Bosnian. So the boys can understand it. Obviously, they're 4 and 5, so they're still learning how to speak it. But I was like, no, do it. I mean, I'm never going to be able to talk to them about it just because I'm not around it like they are.
Yeah.
And, you know, I asked my ex-wife when we were married to teach me, and she's like, hell no. So I'm like, all right, that's fair. I'm all for being able to speak multiple languages and all that.
Yeah.
And there's still not so much the culture and traditions that they have, but there are still quite a few. Are there culture, like tradition or cultural traditions that you are looking to carry on? And
yeah, I think one of the major ones is like the marriage ceremonies. Mm-hmm. Like I just went to one for one of my cousins in Chicago, and I definitely want her to keep that.
And what's that like? How is that different?
It's just like, so they did a traditional wedding where they had like a village elder was the one that married them. Just extravagant outfits, cultural food, just partying, man.
Yeah. Is it like a multiple day thing? Like I've been to an Indian wedding before where I know that
was, you know, like, I think
like a 3 day event.
No, this one was just a 1 day just because it was here in the States. But I think if it was to happen in Nigeria, it'd be a
couple day
thing. Yeah, a couple day thing. But I definitely want to pass that on and just, you know, just being proud of being Nigerian, because it took me a while to embrace that just because I kind of rebelled against it. I wanted to be like I wanted to be like everybody else.
Fit in, yeah.
Yeah. But then I realized I'm not, and that should be applauded as well. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And what I love is when you've coached, you know, a lot of classes at the gym and you'll pump the Nigerian music.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's cool.
I do that all the time and people actually like the music.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny.
I don't know what they're saying, but I can get along with it.
I started doing that because Junior out in Revive, he always plays Brazilian music. And when we do the open mats, I'm like, man, this sounds really similar to Nigerian music. And he's like, yeah, man, it's pretty much the same. We're pretty much the same culture. Like I think I don't remember how you described it, but I think some Africans who were, you know, in the slave trade and everything got moved down to Brazil by the Portuguese. And that's how the cultures are similar. Because I went to a Brazilian restaurant that he suggested, and the name is escaping me. But the food was very similar, too. And I was like, man, I'm going to start playing Nigerian music whenever I'm teaching class just because it's, you know, it's something different. And I just makes me feel good.
Yeah, man. It's happy. It's like upbeat. You know, it's a good rhythm. It's awesome. I love it. But yeah, man, I wanted to, obviously this is a question I definitely wanted to ask. How'd you get into jiu-jitsu?
So this is a fun story. I was, I was doing my master's program and,
here
in St. Louis, and I was at a bar called Humphreys. I don't know if it's still, it's still there.
I think so, right?
I think it is.
Yeah. Pretty sure it is.
Yeah. I remember it being like close to that.
Let's find out.
By that soccer field. So I was there and I saw a flyer for Watson's Martial Arts. And it was like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, wrestling, Muay Thai, MMA. And I was looking for something to, you know, at the time I was just lifting and I was like, I wanted to get into something. I don't really know. And this was 2013.
So this is before you're a police officer?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. This was before I was a police officer. And I was just looking for something to get into, something to stay active. So I went, at that time, Kyle had a 2-week free trial. Mm-hmm. So this was at the first gym, which was like a small, it's like super small, right above a
Watson 1.0, as they refer to it as.
Right above a lifting gym. So I went there for the 2-week free trial and I was like, okay, this is kind of cool. And Kyle, I still remember this because I don't know if Kyle was saying it because I was actually good at jiu-jitsu or if he was trying to like get somebody to sign up. But he was like, hey, man, you're pretty good at this. Have you done this before? And I was like, no, I haven't. So after the 2-week free trial, I was like, well, I'll give it a month. I'll see how I feel in a month. I bought my first gi. Was super like new, couldn't even tie it in anything. I still have that picture on my Instagram of just me in my parents' kitchen, just like I'm so happy.
Yeah,
first day of school.
Yeah.
So I signed up for a month and you know, just learned and kept going. And I rolled with Ricky.
Okay.
I don't know what he's up to these days, but he was one of the instructors. He was a small, like built like me, but just a little bit taller but skinnier. And you know, I still had that mentality of I mean I'm not well versed in jiu-jitsu, but I'm athletic. I should be able to kind of handle some guy who looks like Ricky. And we did a live round for 5 minutes or 6 minutes, and he submitted me like 12-13 times. Anytime I put my hand down, arm triangle arm bar, and I was like, man, if I saw this dude on the street, I would definitely think I could take him, like,
100%.
And that's just the mentality I had when I first started. And that's after that.
I have a very similar story from my first day, but it was with Amanda at Revive.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I've rolled with her quite a few times, and she, when I was a blue belt, she was whooping my ass.
Yeah. my very first day, she whooped my ass.
And you know, some people take that and they're like, oh, this sport is stupid. I'm never going to do it again. Like, they just get in their feelings about it. I was just like, I want to learn how this dude did all
how
that.
How did you do that? Yeah.
And from that point on, I was fully invested. I was all for it. When I was a police officer, I even changed my schedule to work night shift so I can train like in the morning and in the evening because I was so wanting to do it.
Yeah, so you could hit the morning class and then come back for the evening and then go into your shift.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So and, how long has this been that you've been doing it?
Since 2013.
Okay.
Yeah. So 11. Yeah, 11 years.
11 years, five.
And another thing that pushed me to do it was, again, I was still in that rebellious stage with my parents. And they were like, you know, when I came back with my new gi, they were like, oh, what is that? And I told them what jiu-jitsu was. I tried to explain it because I didn't really know what it was. They just thought it was fighting. Like, again, my parents, they're not savvy with, like, different terminology. Like, it's not fighting in a sense. It's
self-defense.
Yeah, it's like grappling. It's like wrestling.
It's like wrestling where, you know,
But they see the gi and they just think you're kicking the shit out of people.
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, I had childhood asthma growing up and everything. They were like, oh, you're too small. You're going to get hurt and all that type of stuff. And I was like, now I'm really going to do it. Now I'm really going to be good at this sport.
Told me I can't. No, yeah.
And, you know, that's how it is most of the times when your parents say, oh, you're not going to, you know, we don't like this. You're not going to be good at it. When you're at that age, it's like, okay, now I'm going to really do it because it's, you know, it's going to rub you the wrong way.
For sure.
And through that and then just that role with Ricky, I was like, I'm hooked.
Sick. All right. So you train under Kyle for, you know, from what, 2013?
To 2019.
And when you leave to go to California?
Yes.
Okay, so then are you what, a purple belt by then?
Yeah, I was a purple belt. I went to California and I trained at I tested out a few gyms. Like, so when I was in Quantico, after you graduate, you have a certain amount of time to get to your field office. So I decided to get there 8 days early so I could try out a bunch of different gyms. So I drove from Virginia to St. Louis, packed up some of my stuff that the movers weren't going to take, and then drove from St. Louis to California. And I tried out a bunch of different gyms. I went to Corina's gym for a day because one of the guys I worked with as a city cop, his cousin was a black belt under Cobrina. So I trained there for like a day or so just to test it out. But the distance was like maybe 12 miles. But by the time I got off work, there was no way I was going to make it to any of the classes because it's an hour, 30 minutes to drive that distance. Mm. I went to Sean Williams' gym for a little bit. I tried out a bunch of different gyms. I ended up training at a place called Villains BJJ, which is a Damian Maya affiliate. So I trained there for about a year and a half. And then COVID hit, and we ended up doing like Skype gym sessions where the head coach would kind of bring up IBJJF matches and we would just go over it. But it just became like too much because I was working a full day and then I would come home and get on the computer for like two and a half hours for the class.
Really. Training.
Yeah, it's not really training. Yeah. It was mostly studying, which at that time I was already doing on my own. I was already watching matches and some of the matches he was talking about, I had already watched through Flow Grappling or something. So I was like, okay, cool. Then we decided to leave. We moved to Pasadena and then I started looking at gyms there and I saw Logic BJJ and looked up the head coach, Lucas Hocha, and I was like, oh, okay, cool. And I saw some of his matches. I was like, oh, okay, this guy's legit. So then I came to the class, and I just signed up and was part of Logic for a while. They were actually under ZR Team before he went to Logic BJJ. And ZR Team has, or used to have, Gabriel Souza, mm-hmm. Diego Romalo, Martinez, Esteban Martinez, who is the Giant Slayer. He's like this small guy who like does all the absolutes all the time. He's been on Who's Number One quite a few times.
Mm-hmm. Name sounds familiar.
Yeah. So I trained there and that's when I really got heavy into the competition just because there were so many competitions that come through there. I didn't have to travel.
Right. And that's what sucks here in St. Louis is like, I mean, really, IBJJF's going to come here maybe once. I mean, their first time coming here was last year.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, we can't bank on that. You know, we have to travel. Mm-hmm. We want to go to these big competitions.
Yeah, that was one of the best things about California because like the local competitions, like Jiu-Jitsu World League, and a few others, they were happening. It seemed like every other weekend, and
well, it's so popular there too.
Exactly, everybody trains, and the major competitions that were held in Long Beach, which was like maybe a 20-30 minute drive. So again, no hotel fees. I just pay the entry fee and that's pretty much it to compete. So I got really heavy into just trying to compete as much as possible. Won a few, you know, good titles at Purple Belt. Was actually ranked and I don't really care about rankings because I didn't really look at them, but I was ranked number 5 for featherweight at Purple, and that was because of my Masters International win that I had that year. And I was just like, man, this is really cool. The fact that I didn't have to pay was great. Yeah. Like I could just go home to where I was living and not have to deal with hotels or Ubers or, you know, anything like that. I could plan out my day based on, okay, the competition is at this time. Right. I don't have to be at the venue all day. I can just drive there, compete, and then drive home. So it was a lot of fun to be out there competing.
It's awesome.
Jinx. Oh man. So then you move back here and just train, and now you're training under Kyle, coaching at the gym, teaching the no-gi classes, teaching covering my classes for me all the time.
What do you prefer, gi or no-gi?
I'm a gi guy. I mean, I've been doing.
Guy's got an absurd gi collection.
Yeah, I've got like 35 gis. Okay. I've been giving away a few because I'm making room for. newer ones? Making
we're about six on a dog.
Yeah, I definitely gave Zach one of the show your rolls.
Yeah.
Like, you know, people have different things that they collect. Some people collect sneakers or coins. I'm collecting gis. Like, okay. I've got a limited edition gi that I will wear when I get the black belt, and I'll probably put it in one of these cases. Things and never touch it again. It took me like 6 months to get that gi.
Yeah, get those off of Amazon for pretty cheap.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they're like, yeah, there's a lot of gis out there.
I'm
that
talking
are like,
about the boxes.
Oh,
yeah, the shadow boxes.
The shadow boxes. Yeah. But yeah, there's a lot of gis out there that are like, you know, like limited edition. They do like the drops and stuff, kind of like people do with sneakers and stuff. So,
and you won't see that gi again for
ever
a long time. Yeah. So it took me quite a while to get that one. I had to finagle and make sure that I was like clicking entry, like trying to get it in my size. That's the biggest thing too.
Yeah.
Because I want it in my size. So I'm an A1, which is pretty common, actually. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty common gi size.
I would say A1 and A2. Have
to say, shit, I'm an A2. I guess I can't get any donated to me.
Yeah.
I'm an A2. I mean, that's the thing, is a gis are like, you know, every make is like, I've three or four show your rolls. Everyone fits a little different, you know, like they're not, I would not say that like, just cause you're an A1 and one doesn't necessarily mean you can't fit in an A2. And you know, I'm sure there's an A2 that probably might fit you.
Yeah.
You know, like I've got a really small A2 downstairs that I bet would fit you, cause it's smaller than the show your roll you gave me.
Yeah.
You know,
so. There's a range. So you could probably get away with fitting, quite a few different, you can go up one, you can go down one, you can stay in between. There's a few A1s that I have that the sleeves are too long, but everything else fits fine. There's a few where the pant legs are too short, but everything else fits fine. So it kind of depends.
Yeah, that's like the one you gave me. The pants are a little short, but like everything else fits perfect. So I'm like, well, definitely wearing this. It's sick.
Yeah. That's my and your purple belt.
Yeah,
so.
That's my favorite gi I have now. Yeah, for sure. By far, it's the sickest one.
Yeah, when I got purple belt, I kind of went crazy with the purple belt, like swag. Like everything was like purple.
That's like a meme that you'll see online, that like when people get their purple belt, like everything they start wearing is like purple. They start buying purple everything.
Yeah, you know? I bought purple rash guards, purple gis, and I was like, wait, maybe I shouldn't spend so much money on purple gis because the next belt is brown.
Yeah, you're not going to be there for that long.
I'm not going to be there for too terribly long.
Yeah, it's like you don't really want to wear your old, you know, like once you're a purple belt, like I don't really want to put on my blue belt. So, you know?
Yeah, true.
You know? It's just like, yeah, you want to be what you're ranked as, you know?
Yeah.
When you started the YouTube channel. When did that kind of get rolling? Because that's got, you know, a good amount of subscribers, man. That's awesome.
Yeah, I started that when I was in California under Lucas Hocha. So the Ursinho came about because
how do you say it? Ursinho?
Ursinho, yeah. Which is Portuguese for little bear. So I go by Uzo as my nickname. So my coach, Lucas, he was like, again, he's like very Brazilian. So when I said Uzo, he heard Orso, which is Portuguese for bear. Mm. So he was calling me bear throughout the classes, and I just didn't have the heart to tell him, like, no, it's not Orso, it's actually Uzo. I finally did tell him, I was like, it's actually Uzo, not Orso. And he's like, oh, I'll call you Ursinho for little bear, because you move like bear. And I was like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. The name. I got my origin started. Yeah. That's the name I'm going to keep. So
that's the name of your YouTube channel?
Yeah, Ursinho BJJ. So I started just repping that. The design... That's not on here, but the design of the bear, I had it designed by my one of my friends named Kelly, who I went to Mizzou with. She was a graphic designer. So I was like, hey, I got this idea. Can you make something happen with this?
Make me a logo.
Yeah. And she knocked it out of the park.
That's awesome.
But yeah, that's how the name started. And I just started repping that wherever. It also actually helped in competition, because again, IBJJF is run by a lot of Brazilians. Everything is run by Brazilians. So when they see Ursinho on the back of your gi, and as long as I don't say anything except for like obrigado, which means thank you, I might pass for Brazilian.
Right. Yeah,
so if it comes down to like 0-0 and we need to give the nod to somebody, you know, I'm not saying it helped, but it helped.
Oh, it definitely helps. Like there's, at least from what I hear, the IBJJF refs can be very, can be a little biased towards Brazilian competitors.
Yeah, for sure. So if they, you know, if he says obrigado and he's got Ursinho and he's, you know, my complexion, he might be Brazilian.
Yeah. That's great. So yeah, you started the YouTube channel. You tell us about your YouTube.
Yeah. So like I said, it started, I just wanted to film myself just to see where I was making mistakes. That's how it started. I had no intentions of ever posting any of my matches or anything, just mostly because I was like, no one's going to watch this purple belt just be on here talking. And so I was watching my matches and I was kind of like talking to myself like, okay, I can do that better. Or this is where I made a mistake and this is how this guy capitalized on it. And my wife was like, you should post that because the way you're talking about jiu-jitsu, like I'm even following it. And she doesn't train at all. What she knows about jiu-jitsu is from me talking about it, me competing, and then watching it on Blow Grappling. So I was like, okay, let me try this out. So I recorded a roll. My very first roll was with one of my teammates out in Logic. Back when I was a purple, he was a brown. And, you know, I just put my phone on a little camera stand, on the little tripod. Didn't have, like, a gimbal or anything like that. I was like, I'm just going to record it and see what happens. We rolled off the frame. Like, it was like, real, real shoddy work. But I posted it, and people were like, oh, that's pretty cool. Like, I'm following what you're doing. I was like, oh, yeah, people aren't dunking on this ratty video. And then the next big test was posting it to Reddit, where everybody like just dunks on everybody. Like, that's just the thing. But I posted it and people were like, wow, that was a good pendulum sweep, or, you know, your close guard is pretty good. And I was like, okay, maybe I have something here. So from there, I just started posting more videos and started looking at like how to, you know, get the 360 view, get the gimbal set up and everything like that. And just the following just kept going. People kept, you know, liking the videos, watching them. And then I think the channel kind of took off when I did a video on how to tie your belt. It's called like the super lock or lock method, where the knot doesn't really come undone and it looks really nice. So I learned how to do that. And I just made like a 30-second video on how to tie it.
Mm. I feel like that's the time on that is really important.
Yeah.
You know, at least I remember, I feel like people always want to see like the shortest video possible for like little things like that on like how to's. Like,
yeah.
I'm like, man, I don't want to go through this whole 10-minute video. Just show me how to do it. Yeah.
And that's why I kept it to like 30 seconds, because I was like, there's no intro. Like, I'm not talking about like these are like why you would want to tie your belt. Like, nobody cares about that. They just want to see how you tie it real quick. So I posted that and it just took off. People loved it. And from there, I was like, okay, well, I know that there's BJJ Scout, who I used to watch to get breakdowns of people's techniques. So I was like, okay, I'm going to start breaking down not only my roles, but also, you know, high-level black belt roles. Because when I was coming up, I didn't watch jiu-jitsu until maybe like late blue, early purple, just because I couldn't follow what was going on. I was too new to the sport, and I didn't really understand what people were doing. At purple, I was like, okay, I can see people's setups now. I can, especially after competing. It's like, I can see people's setups. I can see where they're going to go. So now the sport is more exciting because I can follow it. So I was like, okay, well, there's a whole section of people who either want to get into the sport, who are already in the sport, but don't know too much. And I want to help those people out. So I started breaking down like what I'm doing when I roll. So I did a bunch of breakdowns of rolling with white belts and rolling with blue belts. Because as an upper belt at the time, I don't smash like white belts and blue belts. I let them explore. Like, I let them work their offense. I let them work their defense. I don't just go out there and put my competition A game on them, because it's not fun. I don't get to work on my timing because they're not attacking, because I'm just beating them the entire round, and they don't get to work on offense or defense or like explore different positions. So I did a bunch of videos on how to roll with like white belts and blue belts, and people just loved it. And from there, I was like, okay, I'm going to break down high-level matches so people can see why people are going for certain grips and how these setups lead to different things. And from there, it just
took off.
I'm sure that helped you, too, when it came to competition. You're watching all these videos and talking about all these setups, and you can start seeing it in the competition. So,
absolutely. It made me laser-focused on not watching for, like, flashy finishes, but watching for the setups, like, okay, this person's going for a cross collar grip. What are they trying to set up from here? Okay, I think they're trying to, you know, hit a collar drag from here to set up a single leg. And then boom, they would hit it. I'm like, okay,
yeah,
now I understand. Now I understand like why grips are important and which grips they're going for to set up whatever they want. Instead of like looking for like, oh, this is boring because there's no flying armbar. Like now I'm watching so I can incorporate those grips and see like if I can use them in my game.
That was a big transition for me when I started. Like I remember just like for probably a couple of years of me training, my first year or two, I like would just grab the first thing I could grab, and I'd just like, all right, what do I do with the sleep grip? I'll just try to make, you know, it's like, no, I want these grips.
Yeah.
These are what I like. I've worked my whole game off of like one set of grips, mm-hmm. you know, or two set of grips really. And, you know, that was just a big game changer for me, is like really that those initial grips that you make, like I love that same side collar, your sleeve, you know, same side sleeve or like whatever I like. But yeah, I just remember that being a huge, huge game changer for me.
Yeah. Another big game changer for me was watching a lot of AOJ, Art of Jiu-Jitsu guys and girls. Because, again, they would do the Jiu-Jitsu World Leagues to get ready for IBJJFs.
That's like a really well-known affiliation?
Or yeah, well-known affiliation. Jiu-Jitsu school has
a tag team. They're AOJ. That's a big one.
They have Hoffa and Guy Mendez, and between them, I think they're like ADCC champions, multiple time world champions, probably some of the best to ever do it. And I always just thought everyone's good there because they're good. Like that's why they're good. So when we used to do the Jiu-Jitsu World Leagues, I would stay and watch the juveniles, like the kids coming up, like maybe like 4 to 9 or however old. And I would watch the AOJ kids. And I was like, man, these kids are moving like AOJ black belt adults. And I was like, okay, it's not just because Gi and Hoffa Mendez are good at jiu-jitsu. They've got a system in place that they're adopting from juvenile all the way up to adult. So I was like, I want to study that. So I started breaking down a lot of Hoffa videos, watching his matches with Cobrinha and Johnny Grippo and all of these techniques. And they came out with an instructional, guard passing instructional, and they just said basically they have 7 different guard passes that they do that everybody does, but they just the way they chain them together is what leads to their success. And I was like, okay, well, I need to see it to believe it. Like you're saying it, but you're also Hoffa Mendez. Like, okay, but when I saw juveniles doing it, kids who you know shouldn't be moving like that, I was like, okay, it's the system. Mm-hmm. So I started implementing. That's when I became a guard passer. I was tired of playing guard. I was like, okay, I want to stay on top. Be on top, stay on top.
That's the whole name of jiu-jitsu. Get on top, stay on top.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. You can submit people from your back, but I mean, at the highest levels, you want to be on top. Think about any sort of fight. You want to be the guy on top.
Yeah.
You know. So that's the whole name of the game.
Yeah. You've got gravity on your side.
Speed on your side.
And more often than not, if it's 0-0, they're mostly going to give it to the top guy.
Yeah.
But that was when I became a guard passer. Just watching those kids, I was like, man, there's got to be something to this. Like, there's no way that it's just the name alone or the school alone that's making these kids good, you know, world champion good. It's the system, and they just implemented it to a point where it's just like, it's clockwork.
I've talked with Zach about this. I mean, I'm looking to get into it and looking to get my boys into it. They're 4 and 5. What advice do you have for people that are getting started?
The advice I have for people that are getting started, I would say, give it an honest try. You know, depending on what day you go into the gym, you might be working something that's just like, no, this isn't for me. Like
sure.
if you go in and you're working like north, south Kimura, where someone's kind of like sitting on your face and wrenching your arm behind your back. You're probably going to walk out of there. But I would say give it an honest chance, because you never know, you know, the types of things you can learn, the types of friends you're going to end up making. Like I've made lifelong friends from the sport. And I would say focus on the defensive aspects of jiu-jitsu. Learn your side control escapes, learn your mount escapes, learn your close guard breaks. I'm telling you, it seems boring. And it's not, you know, it's not as exciting as learning the armbar or learning the triangle, but learning defense, if you can get out of anybody's attacks, the amount of time you have to attack is now exponentially increased. Like if I can defend everything you're throwing at me, not only does it demoralize you because nothing you can do works on me, but I can get out and now I can start attacking. So I think focusing on defense would probably be the best, especially side control, because it sucks. I mean, it sucks at all levels, but when you're brand new, you're going to be in side control a lot, like a lot from a lot of different people. So working on the defense is probably the best advice.
The way I talk about that in my class, I call it the eating your vegetables of jiu-jitsu. Yeah. You know, it's not the fun, sexy stuff to get good at. Or, I mean, it's not the fun, sexy stuff to drill, but it is the stuff you really need to be good at, because being stuck in the bottom of, you know, a guy that is 60 pounds heavier than you, side control is not a fun place to be.
Yeah.
As I know you and I have both spent a lot of time.
Yeah, in. Yeah.
Yeah.
But if you can escape from there and you can launch your attacks, then... Yeah. Now you're on offense.
100%.
One of the things I've learned as a resident, like, white belt in the group, and I mean, I have a few years experience, it's just super inconsistent, is that, like, you become enamored with the idea of, like, getting the submission, but if you don't know how to set it up and you don't understand the fundamentals of, like, what I think it was Hicks and Gracie called invisible jiu-jitsu, then it doesn't matter if you know how to complete an arm bar or a kimura or anything. It's like, you're very susceptible to getting your ass handed to you. And otherwise, like, if you don't know the escapes, if you don't know the sweeps, if you don't know the reversals, like, yeah, you focus on the stuff that's attractive, but it's not effective.
Yeah. That's something that I talk about in Nogi as well. Just whenever anybody asks me, like, how to do submissions, I'll show you how to do the submission. But if you don't understand, like, the setup or the off-balancing to get there, well, it's not going to help you out. You know, you'll never get the chance to attack if you don't know how to defend and how to set up the attack.
I guess the one thing that'll help me with that is that I've always been, I guess, defensive minded in every sport that I played. I mean, hockey, I was a defenseman. Baseball, I was a pitcher. Defense, football, right. I was on the defensive side. Like, I guess I'm always just kind of been more defensive minded. So it sounds exciting.
Yeah, sure. Just for that stuff. Just learning how to get out is. I mean, it's such a valuable skill to learn. You know, even in like a self defense aspect. You know, even though. You know, the average attacker is probably not going to be a trained jiu-jitsu person.
Yeah.
More than likely, if we look at statistics, but so they're probably going to be holding you in side control, but you never know. Mm-hmm. But it is. Oh, it's just a good thing to know how to get out of the bottom position, and even, you know, whether that's to get away or to just to attack.
Yeah, and also me being like, I compete at light feather and featherweight, so that's 141 to 154. I'm not a big guy to begin with. So I really need to know how to escape, because I need to utilize my speed, and I can't utilize it if somebody's laying on top of me, you know? Right.
100%.
I think another thing that's important that I didn't find out until, you know, I think it was like around blue belt or so, is watch different types of jiu-jitsu. And what I mean by types is, like, I watch a lot of female jiu-jitsu as well, because, again, it's fun to watch, like, Lucas Hart, Hulk Barbosa, and like Buchecha, but I'm not built like that. Right. Like, what you can do to get out of side control, I can't feasibly do.
Dudes are built like, you know, bodybuilders.
Yeah, like 6'3", like 220, like lean. Jacked. I'm not that. So I started watching a lot of female jiu-jitsu. Michelle Nicolini, Mackenzie Dern, when she was, before she went to MMA, Maisa Bassos, Gabriela Passagna. Mostly because they're technical, based on being smaller competitors, right? They move in a way that doesn't rely too much on strength, and I incorporated that into my game. And that's like Michelle Nicolini's spider shin to shin. I still play that to this day if I'm working spider guard, just because it's so versatile, and the way she utilizes it, I can utilize it because we're built similarly. Yeah. You know, I might outweigh her, but technically, compared to like somebody who's like 180, we might as well be the same. You know, so utilizing that technique that the women's jiu-jitsu has definitely helped me become way better.
What days do you teach?
I teach Tuesday, Thursdays.
Right after my class.
Yep, okay. 7 to 8 p.m., the no-gi classes. And then I hop in whenever, you know, somebody needs a class covered, or Kyle, you know, if he's going to go coach somebody or out of town or something, I'll try to fit in some other classes.
Zach, when you teach?
The ones right before him.
Yeah.
Six to seven. He does. He goes 7 to 8. So we're back to back, basically. Yep. So last one. How do you manage all this stuff, man? You're a dad, jiu-jitsu competitor, got a full-time career, you know, YouTuber, you got all this stuff you got going on. Like, how do you manage everything?
Man, it's it's been dicey lately because baby girl, you know, that
it all
comes
changes
first.
When you have a kid, man. That was huge for me. That was a big wake up call.
Yeah, dude. I thought I was still going to be able to train as much as, I mean, I train pretty decently. I think the way I manage the time is just, I focus on what's important. Mm-hmm. I don't really go out too much. I spend a lot of time, you know, with my wife and kid. If I'm not in the gym, obviously I'm at work. I just manage the time based on what's important. I cut out a lot of stuff that I used to do that was fun, but wasn't like progressing towards the goals that I want. Like I want to become a pretty proficient black belt. I want to own my own gym. I want my daughter to take to jiu-jitsu. If not, at least learn self-defense. I want the YouTube channel to grow. So I just put, you know, hey, if it's not working towards that, then I need to just put it to the side because it's not as important as these other things. I think also having a spouse that's like super supportive of,
dude, that's everything, man.
Because without that, there's no, you know, there's no YouTube channel. There's definitely not me training as much as I get to train. Like my wife will bring Amara to the gym, so I get to train, and then in between breaks, I get to hang out with her, and then she gets to see all the people I train with. Pretty much consider most people at Watson's my family. Mm-hmm. Like I spend so much time there, they might as well be family. So she gets to see me interact with people, gets to see me teach people, gets to be around the mats and the environment, and I still get to train. So having a spouse that understands like, hey, this is where I want my life to kind of go. Having that support is paramount.
I totally agree, man. I totally relate to that.
Yeah. Well, hockey ends at the end of this month. And so I was thinking about,
woohoo, shit, dude. Yeah. I can't wait.
You coming to Watson's? Oh, okay, awesome.
I wouldn't let him go anywhere.
Yeah, yeah. That's tough.
We might have to change our podcast. You know, I don't know. I'm just fucking around. anyway, man, was there anything before we get out of here? Is there anything you wanted to plug?
Just check out the YouTube channel. It's Arsenio BJJ. I also have a TikTok for jiu-jitsu, Arsenio BJJ, and also Facebook, Arsenio BJJ. Everything
Instagram,
is Arsenio BJJ.
I got one more thing that we ended on.
Oh, yeah. Forgot about that.
Called the Tombstone Game.
Okay.
All right. So here lies Uzo. What's it say on your tombstone?
Man. Okay. Here lies Uzo. It's going to say loving father, badass jiu-jitsu practitioner, and just all around someone you can depend on.
Perfect.
Perfect, man.
Awesome.
Awesome, guys. Well, that'll wrap up the show. If you guys enjoyed it, make sure you hit that like button. Comment what you think or what you thought of the show below. If you aren't subscribed, definitely hit that subscribe button, and we will see you next time.